Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
It's Christmas time across America. For many, the season brings with it the annual return of cherished Christmas traditions, such as leaving milk and cookies out for Santa Claus and his reindeer to enjoy.
North Carolina's Virginia Fox on a bill to allow whole milk in schools.
As for my family, our traditional choice of dairy has always been whole milk. We want only the most nutritional option for Santa. The nutrients in whole milk, like protein, calcium, and vitamin D, provide the fuel Santa needs to travel the whole globe in one night. Whole milk is the unsung hero of his Christmas journey.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A bill to amend the Richard B. Russell National Lunch School Lunch Act to allow schools to participate in the school lunch program under such act to serve whole milk.
Bill introduced by Pennsylvania Representative G.T. Thompson, chairman of the House Ag Committee, but Bobby Scott from Virginia, a Democrat, opposed.
Mr. Chairman, I advise in opposition to H.R. 1147, the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act. School meals are critical in reducing child hunger and providing children with the healthy foods they need. Milk, offered as part of these meals, can help deliver essential nutrients that are vital to a child's development. That is why it is so important that we provide students with the most nutritious milk options. Child nutrition standards for school meals, including milk options, are guided by the Science-Based Dietary Guidelines for Americans, or the DGAs. Regrettably, H.R. 1147 attempts to legislate nutrition standards and disregard the evidence-based recommendations made by the DGAs. Furthermore, the bill would undermine the Biden administration's ongoing rulemaking to better align school nutrition standards with the latest science. This bill would allow schools participating in the National Lunch School Lunch Program to offer whole milk and reduced fat milk, violating the current science-based standards that protect children's health. Whole milk contains far more saturated fat, cholesterol, and calories than fat-free and low-fat milk. Conversely, fat-free and low-fat milk offer the same vital nutrients, including calcium, vitamin D, vitamin A, protein, and potassium, as whole milk.
Scott, a member of the House Ag Committee, but Thompson, the chairman, countered.
Students have been limited to fat-free or reduced-fat milk since the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act was enacted in 2010. While some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have argued that we should not reform individual aspects of the child nutrition, it was that legislation more than a decade ago that singled out milk for regulation, which is why we're here today. There are several reasons why these top-down regulations are harmful to students and school districts that are forced to comply with them. First, we have seen students opt out of consuming milk altogether if they don't have access to a variety that they enjoy. According to the 2020 Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee report, more than two-thirds of school-aged children fail to meet the recommended levels of dairy. Well, no kidding. We took out the most nutritious and most tasty and made it inaccessible to them. Let's face it, the only way to benefit from milk's essential nutrients is to consume it. Now, we're not force-feeding anybody anything. This is about choice. And when students turn away from milk, they often offer far less healthy alternatives that are highly caffeinated, sugar-sweetened, or lack key nutrients. Now, these regulations also perpetuate baseless claims that milk is bad for our kids. Research has shown time and time again that whole and 2% milk are not responsible for childhood obesity and other health concerns. In fact, these beverages are so nutritious that research shows positive health outcomes for kids who consume whole milk.
So just how much fat in whole milk? Derek Van Orden from Wisconsin.
The milk fat content of whole milk is actually 3.25%, making it 96.7% fat-free. So when we look at the science, we read this definition. Milk means the lacteal secretion practically free from colostrum obtained by the complete milking of one or more healthy cows. The reason soy milk's not in there is because it's not milk. Neither is almond milk. Milk comes from a mammal.
The bill passed the House 330 to 99. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
A little bit about river systems because it's the artery of global agricultural trade.
Dan Bossi with Ag Resource speaking at the recent American Seed Trade Association's Field Crop Seed Convention.
If you think about our Panama Canal, it's at one of its lowest levels on record. And the Panama Canal, if you look in the graphic to your right, the prospect of getting more rainfall there is not good in January, February, March, or April. It really doesn't start to see the rainy season return until you get into May. So the cost of getting grain or any goods through the Panama Canal will stay elevated. The transportation through it will be restricted. There's 88 vessels this morning waiting in the canal, waiting to go through to the other side. Some people are looking at going all the way around the Horn of South America. And that's why freight rates to move grain globally have spiked up rather sharply in the last month. The chart on your left, you see the Baltic Dry Index, which includes grains, is now spiked up and it's at its highest level looking backwards since about 2021. And then you can see, of course, the weekly chart on your left. But again, rising freight rates is all due to the congestion at the Panama Canal, a lack of freight availability in the world. And this, of course, raises the cost to importers that are already struggling with a lack of currency like Egypt or maybe sub-Saharan Africa, where grain, of course, is now becoming more expensive, not only on price, but also on cost to get it there. 2 years in a row now, we've also had something in the United States called our artery of agricultural trade, the Mississippi River, be at record low levels. I can go back in history to about 1882, and I can't find where the Mississippi has been this dry for this long. And so I worry a little bit about what's coming. Now, we've seen flows improve a little bit lately, but again, we need a recharge of the central U.S., and that recharge was supposed to happen in a El Nino year. So far, however, there's lots of soil moisture shortages across the central U.S. And then something we've never seen in my weather history that we can go back is a drought in the Amazon of Brazil. Brazil's, of course, pink porpoises are dying. This is a river system, the Rio Negro, and you can see its flow level is at a record low. And so in 120 years of data, I can't find the Amazon being this dry this long, and we're still not seeing the needed rainfall that's there. My climate scientist has given me these two maps. You can see the map on your left, which is rainfall from September 15th when you can plant soybeans in Brazil. From a governmental standpoint, that's we plant dates because of rust. And then on the right is, of course, the temperature deviation from September 15th until December 1st. And you get a sense of how dry it's been across a very wet area of the world, the Amazon. Now, there's a climate conference going on as we sit here today. COP28 is being held, of course, in Dubai. And I'm just waiting for someone in that conference to put up their hand and saying, see, deforestation is what's causing this drought in Brazil. It hasn't happened yet, but I imagine at some point it will come back. But again, weather-wise, we don't get this kind of shortage of rainfall that has impacts on crops in a usual tropically wet area. Mato Grosso, a state that's as bigger than Texas, normally gets about 12 inches of rain during the month of December. So far, they've got about 1.7. They're dry, and it's still accentuating the drought that's there. And my climate forecaster would tell you that as you look at Brazil, he's still expecting it to stay warmer and drier than normal in the Amazonian areas for at least another couple of months. And this may continue into, of course, the winter for them, which would be next year, which would affect their winter corn crop. So we've got to be watching Brazil, particularly northern Brazil, very carefully. If you go to southern Brazil, a place called Passo Fundo, which is in Rio Grande do Sul, they've received over 60 inches of rain since September 1st. So when you blend it together, this is what's affecting crop yields globally. It's not that we're not working as hard or technology isn't helping us. Mother Nature's kind of been adverse.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Listen, the first problem with that, and we see it too often, and Tony, this is why we need to get structural reforms into the Farm Bill and into the safety net as opposed to this ad hoc disaster assistance.
Representative Jody Arrington from Texas, chairman of the House Budget Committee, but referring to USDA's rollout of the 2022 ERP program.
If the safety nets don't work because of the input cost or inflation, then you have to do these, year after year disaster relief plans. We have hurricanes and floods and droughts and wildfires, and we need to keep the food supply and the ag economy stable and flowing. And that's a national security issue. And so we passed the $3 billion disaster assistance package. It wasn't enough to help everybody and to cover all of the cost of the losses. But it wasn't administered for an entire year. I guarantee we lost ag producers who couldn't wait, who didn't have the runway, didn't have the equity, and they just had to sell out. The other piece of the protracted time frame has been a real problem, and I've let Secretary Vilsack know that, as have other members of Congress, both House and Senate. But the other letter I wrote to Vilsack was about the inequity in the way this is being distributed, and that is, it ought to be distributed based on the impact. And look, if you want to give consideration to the newer farmers who don't have the equity or smaller farmers, there are already limitations, payment limitations. But what they did, Tony, with this recent disaster relief program called ERP, is they put a provision, it's really a question in their application for these monies, that said, are you a socially disadvantaged farmer or rancher? Basically, in the words were, do you identify as a socially disadvantaged farmer? What they meant was, do you identify as a female or as a minority group? Well, listen, if a female's been impacted by the disaster, she ought to be compensated accordingly and fairly, as should somebody as a member of a minority group. But as they implemented it, the Biden USDA was given 75% more generous payments to people just because of their biological sex or the color of their skin. Buddy, that's discrimination. That goes against the Civil Rights Act, not to mention the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. And it's just plain wrong and un-American. And I was very upset about it. And I guarantee you, your listeners and the producers in West Texas, they didn't take kind to that. So we're trying to get them to reverse that. The courts will reverse it if they don't, but we're trying to pressure them to go back to the way we've done these ERP programs before and quit using identity politics to weaponize the government and pit groups against each other. We are one people with one set of ideals as Americans, and we're one agriculture, and we ought to be compensating these folks based on the damage, not based on characteristics that would be otherwise illegal and discriminatory.
Chairman of the House Budget Committee, Jody Arrington. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There's a primary reason that more than half of all children given milk is thrown into a cafeteria trash can, unused. Carton after carton after carton of discarded cartons of milk that have never been opened. Because at some point, kids realize, this isn't good for me, and they don't drink it.
Debate Wednesday on the floor of the House, where Troy Carter, a Democrat from Louisiana, added,
so whatever nutritional value that you thought you were affording by giving milk doesn't happen if young people can't consume or digest it. Many kids don't want milk because it makes them sick.
The debate was whether or not to allow whole milk back in to the school lunch program.
According to the USDA, 29% of cartons of cow milk served in our schools are thrown into the garbage unopened. This comes out to be somewhere around $300 million in annual waste of the taxpayers' funds for milk cartons. It's clear, not only is it food waste issue, but a failure on the NSLP to supply food to kids that are consumed and meet their daily nutritional requirement. The present rate of food waste and taxpayer losses is unacceptable. I ask my Republican colleagues, do you think it is a good policy? Is it good stewardship of our tax dollars in delivering good, healthy outcomes for all kids? And if you believe it is, then you should agree and recognize that adding a true alternative is a good thing. I remind you, it's not a medical condition to be black, Latino, Asian, or Jewish, or other ethnicities. This is an issue of racial equity and inclusion, as well as tightening government spending and waste.
North Carolina Representative Virginia Fox.
Mr. Chairman, we're very concerned about waste. And one of the reasons there is so much waste is because whole milk is not allowed, and children don't like the taste of skim milk. We are putting children first. We're not excluding soy drink. It is not milk. It is a plant-based food. It isn't milk, so you can't call it soy milk. You can call it soy drink. But it was under our first African-American president in this country that this was designed this way, and the First Lady pushed through these rules and regulations to exclude whole milk, which, by the way, my colleague says has an enormous amount more fat. Well, the fat content of whole milk is about 3.5%. And we're foisting on children 1.5% milk, which doesn't have a very good taste to many of them, and excluding them from 3.5%. And we do not exclude soy drink. This is about inclusion, and it's about equity. We want people to be able to drink the kind of milk they want to drink.
The bill was introduced by the chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
But I have to say, the only special interest here is our kids. And it's our kids that have been cheated out of the nutrition that they need. It's our kids who have, case studies have shown that the rate of obesity and being overweight increased dramatically after access to whole milk and flavor was taken out of the schools. 2007, 2008 was a baseline. 2010, Democrat-led initiative, demonized milk fat. In 2020, 2021, there was a study of that same cohort, and obesity has gone up.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The U.S. Central Bank has only one tool in the box, right? It's a hammer. That hammer is to kill demand with rising rates.
From the American Seed Trade Association's Field Crop Seed Convention, it's Dan Bossi with Ag Resource.
And that's what they were trying to do. What we all needed in the world was more supply. I needed more lumber to build houses. I needed more grain for food. I needed more livestock, all of that. But really, the central bank is hammering demand. And so there's, if you look back in time going to 1950, there's been three soft landings. We believe we're going to get a soft landing this time also, but it's not because of the central bank. It's because of the wage increases that are going on in the economy and the amount of jobs that are still available. But as you look at this again, the central bank is still ready to hammer should inflation rates not come down to their target. So I showed you last year, because of America is now in this position where it will have more people leaving the labor force than coming in, which is why the U.S. Congress needs to do immigration reform. That's not going to change. I'm going to lose anywhere between 500,000 to 1.5 million people from our labor force each and every year. I'm a baby boomer. I'm going to be retiring in the not-too-distant futures, millennials, and then we get the Gen Z, Gen X's. But if you look at the JOLTS report, this is jobs openings. Notice how many jobs are still available in the United States, somewhere around 9.5 million jobs today available should you want to go to work. Just walk around Florida. There's job signs everywhere, coffee shops, restaurants. I'm sure this hotel would hire you. There's plenty of opportunities if people want to work. And so this has softened, if you will, the economic fall of rising rates. More people working, more income has softened where we are today. Nonetheless, when you think about the housing market, it is going to be the most affected by all of this. As you look at interest rates rising, the 30-year note is now back over 7.5%, and mortgage applications have plummeted. So the real soft spot in the U.S. economy is going to be housing. But what I worry about, and I've tried to put the administrations, it may be hard to read in the back, but whether it's G.W. Bush or Clinton or any of these other Obama, and then we go to Trump and Biden, notice how the deficit has just soared. I don't know if you saw the other day, but our friend, Warren Buffett lost his good friend Charlie Munger just a little while ago, a couple days ago. But, you know, Buffett had a comment of how do we solve the debt? Well, we said we just kick out all those congressmen who won't get it down to 3% of GDP. Today, the debt is rising steadily, and with two wars in the background, I don't know what stops this going to $40 trillion in the United States. And remember, in economic theory, the more of something, it gets cheaper in price. So as we keep printing dollars and dollars and dollars, its value is going to decline now that rates are at least peaked or stabilized. And so the dollar index there, we're looking for a gradual erosion of the U.S. dollar going forward. This is good for American agriculture, but again, it's something that may not be favorable for the U.S. Central Bank as inflation hangs on at higher rates than they would desire. Here's a chart looking just so you can see the differential between the value of the dollar and the value of commodities. The U.S. dollar index is in blue. The CRB index, that basket of commodities, is in black. Notice that there's an inverse relationship. As the dollar gets weaker, commodity values tend to rise. And so we're of this opinion that commodity values are, again, making a longer-term bottom here, and the year ahead will be better for agriculture in terms of a profitability level than the one just passed. But in the background, again, as I mentioned, is all of this debt. You see government debt on the right skyrocketing. On the left, you've got consumer debt, whether it's mortgages or credits or auto loans. We're now reaching levels of around, you know, $17 trillion. So combining that, this will have a dampening effect on consumer demand longer term. And you need to be aware that this debt box, if you will, is something we're going to be worried about for many years to come.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Everything we do is in service to our public mission. We at the Fed will do everything we can to achieve our maximum employment and price stability goals.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, at a press conference following the FOMC meeting Wednesday.
We do say that in determining the extent of any additional policy firming that may be appropriate, so any additional policy firming, that sentence. So we added the word any as an acknowledgement that we believe that we are likely at or near the peak rate for this cycle. Participants didn't write down additional hikes that we believe are likely, so that's what we wrote down. But participants also didn't want to take the possibility of further hikes off the table, so that's really what we were thinking.
So one question is, have we reached the top? Are we finished with rising interest rates?
So the way we're looking at it is really this. When we started out, right, we said the first question is how fast to move, and we moved very fast. The second question is how high to raise the policy rate. And that's really the question that we're still on here. We're very focused on that. As I mentioned, people generally think that we're at or near that and think it's not likely that we will hike, although they don't take that possibility off the table. So that's when you get to that question and that's your answer, there's a naturally it begins to be the next question, which is when it will become appropriate to begin dialing back the amount of policy restraint that's in place. So that's really the next question. And that's what people are thinking about and talking about. And I would just say this. We are seeing, strong growth that appears to be moderating. We're seeing a labor market that is coming back into balance by so many measures, and we're seeing inflation making real progress. These are the things we've been wanting to see. We can't know. We still have a ways to go. No one is declaring victory. That would be premature, and we can't be guaranteed of this progress. So we're moving carefully in making that assessment of whether we need to do more or not. That's really the question that we're on. But, of course, the question of when will it become appropriate to begin dialing back the amount of policy restraint in place, that begins to come into view and is clearly a topic of discussion out in the world and also a discussion for us at our meeting today.
And a lot of the moves by the Fed was to eliminate the possibility of a deep recession.
I think you can say that there's little basis for thinking that the economy is in a recession now. I would say that. I think there's always a probability that there will be a recession in the next year, and it's a meaningful probability no matter what the economy is doing. So it's always a real possibility. The question is it it's a possibility here. I have always felt since the beginning that there was a possibility because of the unusual situation that the economy could cool off in a way that enabled inflation to come down without the kind of large job losses that have often been associated with high inflation and tightening cycles. So far, that's what we're seeing. That's what many forecasters on and off the committee are seeing. This result is not guaranteed. It is far too early to declare victory. And there are certainly risks. It's certainly possible that the economy will behave in an unexpected way. It has done that repeatedly in the post-pandemic period. Nonetheless, where we are is we see the things that I mentioned.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The current administration in Mexico continues to stick by its plan to ban imports of U.S. genetically modified corn starting January 1st of 2024. That is the policy of the current Mexican administration. However,
on September 30th, that administration leaves office.
Which could change things, maybe. According to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, he told reporters Sunday there's no scientifically based reason for Mexico to ban GM corn, and that trade ought to be based on science. And on that score,
the two candidates for president, the leading candidate is a scientist. My hope and belief is that as a result of the new administration, they will take a look at the science, take a look at the fact that they are reliant on the U.S. for yellow corn, and that the relationship with the U.S. is important.
He said he made that point again when he met with his Mexican counterpart during the just-concluded U.N. Climate Conference in Dubai. Gary Crawford, Washington.